Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Over the past several years, college campuses around the country are finally beginning to confront the all-too-common reality of sexual assault on campus. For many years, campuses have denied the problem or have reporting procedures that seemingly were more interested in protecting the rights of an alleged perpetrator over the rights of a victim and less in transparent cooperation with law enforcement. And if the perpetrator was a student-athlete, then the situation becomes even more fraught, as a number of high-profile incidents in recent years have shown at Baylor, Vanderbilt, even at Duke, where the alleged perpetrators were eventually exonerated. The fact remains, 1 in 5 women will be the victim of an attempted or actual rape on a college campus, according to the Department of Justice statistics. 90% of those women will know their attacker, and 80% will never report it. And student-athletes, while representing 3.3% of a college population, they also represent 19% of sexual assault perpetrators and 35% of domestic violence incidences. My guest today was gang raped by 4 men in 1998, two of which were Oregon State football players. Brenda Tracy faced an immediate backlash from the community, from the university, even law enforcement, and eventually withdrew those charges in the face of death threats against herself and her family. Finally, in 2014, the registered nurse began speaking out about her rape and the system's indifference. Today, she speaks at universities and with university athletes around the country about her story. She spoke to University of Tulsa student athletes last night. She's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Brenda Tracy, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You were a guest of the University of Tulsa talking to their student athletes about really your situation and what your work as an activist against sexual violence on campus today. And that work has started over the last several years when you finally decided to come out about a horrific incident in 1998 when you were sexually assaulted and raped, gang raped actually, mm-hmm. by 4 men at Oregon State, and 2 of which were football players. What went into the decision to start talking about this publicly? I mean, because it was so much later. It was almost,
16 years after it happened, yeah.
Yeah.
It was the end of 2014, so it's been not quite 3 years since I came forward with my story. It wasn't intentional. Like, I never expected to become a speaker or anything. I think in 2014, I had turned 40, and I kind of had one of those moments where you look in the mirror, and I thought, you know, am I going to keep living my life like this? Because at the time, I just was living a double life. You know, on one side of my life, I looked like I had it all together. I was a registered nurse. I was a single mom. I had raised my sons. I was doing very well from, like, the public view. But on the other side, I was struggling. You know, for the 16 years after my rape, there was depression and suicidal ideation and a lot of self-hate, a lot of self-loathing.
Was it reliving, the incident or the aftermath?
Yeah, it's just the aftermath. I mean, I just mm-hmm. felt that I was damaged and I was ruined. How could anyone ever love me or want to be with me type thing? And so in 2014, I just was desperate for something different. I just wanted to be happy. I wanted to live a normal life. And so I started going to counseling, and a couple sessions in, we started talking about what happened in Corvallis. And that prompted me to try to kind of seek out some information from the school and try to just find healing, really, is what I was trying to do. And through a series of events, I kind of hit some dead ends, and nobody wanted to help me and nobody wanted to talk to me. And so I ended up very accidentally just reading an article about Coach Riley. At the time, in 1998, he had given my rapist a 1-game suspension and said, these are really good guys that made a bad choice. And so those words had haunted me literally for 16 years. I mean, I was very angry about that. And so I found this article about him that he'd given a player a 1-game suspension for domestic violence. And I just very, in the heat of the moment, sent an email to the reporter saying, he's not a great coach. This is what happened to me, and I'm angry. And
this was his second stint at Oregon State, correct?
Yeah, yeah. He was there in 1998, and then he left, went to the pros for a while, and came back to Oregon State. Yeah.
Right.
And so I wrote the reporter this angry email, not expecting anything to happen from it, but he emailed me back, and he said, do you want to talk? And I said, yeah. He was the first person, actually, that I had reached out to that said, you know, I want to hear your story. So I sat down with him and talked to him, and it was John Canzano from the Oregonian, our major newspaper. And he said, you know, if you just want to talk to Coach Riley, you obviously have unfinished business with him. If you want to talk to him, I'll set up that meeting. But if you want to tell your story, I'll tell your story. And I looked at him and said, what story? Who cares? Nobody cared 16 years ago. Why would anybody care now? And he said, no, I think you could help someone. And I said, okay, what do I have to lose? Put my name and my face on it.
So when you went back to Oregon State, was it a wall or did was there just nobody?
I called Oregon State University and I said, you know, I told them who I was and I was just looking for information. I wanted to know what happened to them, right? Because I had reported to the school in 1998 and they said they would do something about it. All I knew about was the one game suspension. So I wanted to own my story. I wanted to know the details. I wanted to know, was there suspension? Was there probation? What happened to them? What did the school do? And I was told that they couldn't tell me because of confidentiality. And, you know, someone made a comment to me, you know, why do you want this information? Are you planning to litigate? And I was like, I'm just in therapy. I just want to own my story and get better. That was the only intention I had. And I didn't understand what the resistance was. Then I consulted a lawyer and they said, you really don't have any rights. You weren't a student at the time. You're just going to have to work with the school. And I was like, but the school won't work with me. So it was like a vicious cycle, right? Nobody wanted to help me. So then I just kind of thought, well, maybe my healing starts with Coach Riley. He was at the school at the time, and I was angry with him, and I thought maybe that's where I start. And then so I had found him, Googling him, found that article.
If I remember right, you said at that point you actually hated him worse than your perpetrators.
I did, and I tell – and people kind of look at me like, that's weird. Like, why would you hate him more than your rapist? But the reason is because I can rationalize a rapist. Like, this is what they do. They hurt people. I can't rationalize good people not doing the right thing. And I couldn't rationalize this football coach giving a one-game suspension for a gang rape and also saying that these are good guys that made a bad choice. I don't think any type of sexual assault is a bad choice. There are things that are bad choices, and that's not one.
So the article came out. I guess it was pretty much a bombshell, right?
Yeah, kind of. I think so. Nobody really knew about it. It was interesting. It had been, you know, it was made public in 1998, but it kind of went away very quickly.
Well, and we'll get into this in a moment, but when it became public, people knew, even though the victim's name wasn't announced at the time.
It was Jane Doe, right? But people knew it was me.
Right, exactly.
Absolutely. I mean, that word spread like wildfire. It was immediate. Everyone knew who I was. And the backlash was quick. It was severe. It was swift. I think that back then we didn't have social media, but, you know, we had the news, we had the newspaper, we had the radio, and I was the top subject.
Could you imagine
immediately.
Can you imagine it today?
Oh,
it's got to be 100 times worse.
It would have been a million times worse. And I started receiving death threats. You know, friends, family turned on me. People abandoned me. You know, the biggest question was, who is she and why is she lying? That was the question everybody wanted to know. Nobody really said, like, are you okay? What happened? Nobody really cared except for, you know, my parents. But everybody else wanted to know why I was trying to ruin their lives and their promising football careers.
And that reaction really hasn't changed that much.
It hasn't changed at all.
In 18 years.
No, my rape happened nearly almost 20 years ago now. And it's the same exact thing. Anytime someone comes forward against a person of power, money, celebrity, athlete, the first question is, who are they and why are they lying and what do they have to gain from this?
How do we change that?
I think, number one, we have to start believing survivors. We have to start understanding that this is something that happens. And just because a person has money or they're really smart or they're a celebrity or they're an athlete doesn't mean that they can't commit the crime of rape. I mean, some rapists have great athletic ability and they're smart. They're regular people. In my talks, I ask the students, what does a rapist look like? And everybody just kind of goes, well, like anyone. And I'm like, that's right. They are like anybody. They're people that we know. And I know that it's hard for us to understand, you know, I could know this person and they could commit this crime, but it's true. And we have to start believing survivors. And we have to start believing that people are committing this crime. Like, we know it's being committed. Why are we not believing that someone could do that to another person?
Here in Oklahoma, several years ago, there was a University of Oklahoma running back, Joe Mixon, who this wasn't a sexual assault, but it was a domestic assault. And it was, I mean, literally, he cold cocked a lady.
Yes, he broke her face.
Yeah, broke her face. And immediately the reaction was against this young lady.
Right. Now, what did she do to cause it?
What did she do to deserve it? I think you almost said that.
Really, and it's both.
And that's the reaction, really.
It is both, yes. There's people that are like, what did she do to cause it, right? Because they don't want to say, what did she do to deserve it? Because no one deserves that.
No, right.
But it's both, right? It's intermixed.
What did she do to cause it? Isn't that at the heart of what a lot of people are thinking?
Yeah, it's a lot of victim blaming is what it is. And I think it's interesting, the whole victim blaming thing, because if I can blame the victim, then it takes the responsibility away from the perpetrator and it makes them okay. And then I'm able to rationalize why I'm siding with the perpetrator and why it's okay for me to continue to root him on to play football and not mess up my Sunday football. Right? Because if I can say to the victim, what were you wearing? What were you doing? Were you drinking? What did you say? What did you do to cause this? Then that takes all the responsibility away from the perpetrator.
I'm assuming, are those questions that are still being asked of every single victim of sexual assault?
All the time. People want to figure out what the problem is. Nobody just wants to say that this is a person that did the wrong thing and that consequences should be handed down. We don't want to punish our heroes. And athletes and celebrities are our heroes, and we worship them, and we have this box we put them in. They play for us Sundays, and they're on our TV every Thursday night or whatever, and we want them to be that person, and I want to change that. And so anything we can do to dismiss the victim and absolve that person, we do. We do it.
My guest today is Brenda Tracy. She is a nurse and activist against sexual violence on campus. She was gang raped in 1998 by four men on the Oregon State campus, two of which were Oregon State football players. They were arrested.
Yes.
Because of the backlash, you eventually declined to press charges at the time. Or was it that simple? Or
yeah, what happened was, like I said, a lot of people turned on me, right? There's a lot of backlash.
Death threats.
From community.
Against your children.
Death threats against my two sons, my young boys.
Wow.
And, you know, in the caller used, like, their full names, their address. I mean, it wasn't just, like, a random thing. It was, like, this person knows intimate details about my family. And then the DA, the biggest thing is the DA said I didn't have a good case. The DA at the time told me I would have to go through four separate trials. It could take years. And that I wouldn't win. It was a he said, she said case. So based on all of that information, I felt that I made an informed decision. And I said, fine, then I declined to prosecute. I'm not going to cooperate anymore, because what's the point? If you're saying I can't win, what is the point of going through this anymore?
Did you find that Oregon State looked at the fact that you declined to press charges and that led to the leniency against the two football players? Or
at the time, I thought that was probably what was happening. You know, and it's interesting because when I dropped the charges, then that was a new news story, right? That was in the media again. And what people said this time was, see, we told you she was a liar.
Right.
If she had been raped, she would be prosecuting. Again, something that happens today. People not taking into account what victims have to go through to even get a prosecution. And I'm sorry, but who's going to take on four trials if the DA is saying you can't win? You know what I mean? Like, why would I push forward with this if the DA is saying we can't win? What would be the point of doing that? So there's a lot more that goes into these decision makings than just, oh, I recanted because I'm a liar. That's not the case at all. But at the time back then, yeah, I thought that, well, actually, I thought maybe something else was going on at Oregon State, because I actually, once I dropped the charges, I went to the school and I reported. Even though I wasn't a student, I said, this is what happened to me. I want to make sure you know this is what's going on. I don't want this to happen to anyone else. And they assured me they would do something. I thought that I only knew about the one game suspension because that was what was in the news. Because, again, today, what makes it to the news? Anything happening with athletics. Other stuff can be going on a campus, but who do you hear about? You hear about the athletes, basically. So I thought that was what was going on, and I just didn't know what it was that they did.
Did these young men have a history, a serial history? Because most rapists do.
Yeah, not that I know of. I know there was an investigation done when my story came out. We found out the real facts of what was going on in 1998. One of them was, I think he was on probation or parole or something for like robbery or something. Mm-hmm. But I'm not aware of anything else.
Mm. Well, this points up a bigger issue that you're also talking about when you go to college campuses and just how college deal with sexual assault. It's mm-hmm. It's been an increasing issue. The federal government has made it a bigger issue over the last 5, 6, 7 years.
Yeah.
But the statistics are really, really bad.
Yeah, they're terrible.
1 in 5 women will either be a victim of an attempted or actual rape.
Yep, during their college years.
90% will know their attacker, and 80% will not report it.
Right. And the reason they don't is, you know, going back to my own story, you know, when I came forward in 2014, an investigation was done by my reporter and by President Ed Ray at Oregon State University. And what we found out was that the DA lied to me in 1998. They had taped confessions from all four men. The police threw away my rape kit that I had done at the hospital. They threw away all of my evidence.
Was this due to just because they were football heroes?
Yeah, they were trying to protect the athletic department. They were trying to protect the football program.
But they had confessions?
They had confessions. What happened was the athletic department was in debt, I think over $1 million. They were courting the Reeser family for a large money donation to the athletic department. Parker Stadium is the football stadium in 1998. In 1999, it was renamed Research Stadium and renovated, right? So they had a vested interest in making sure to cover up my rape because of money in a football stadium, basically. And this is something that's gone on for years and decades now, that schools are not handling these reports the way that they're supposed to. They're covering things up. They're ignoring them. There's a movie called The Hunting Ground that came out, and it showed that, you know, there were lots of schools reporting that they had no sexual assaults on their campuses. But we know that the number is 1 in 5. So how do you have so many people reporting that they've been raped and assaulted, but yet the school is saying we have nothing happening on our campus? Yeah. It's insane.
Has anything changed about the way colleges are, their procedures in reporting sexual assault and what they're actually doing in the aftermath?
Yeah, there have been some changes. In 2011, the Dear Colleague letter came out, which basically told campuses they need to start dealing with this issue, making it a priority. So we started seeing a lot of movement around Title IX, which is policies and procedures and making sure the students
quality
are safe
of
on
gender.
Campus. Yeah. Yeah. And so we started seeing a lot of movement around that, a lot of national discussion about it. And reports have gone up tremendously on a lot of campuses, which is a good thing, right? If the reports are going up, that means that our campuses are doing the right thing. Survivors feel safe to come forward and make a report. Doesn't mean you have a bad campus if you have a lot of reports. It means they're doing something right. And so we're seeing a lot of that. I don't know that we're seeing a lot of cases being handled correctly, right? We're still working on it. This is all a work in progress. You know, and false reports are 2 to 8%. Right. So let's just round it up and give them the benefit of the doubt. Let's say 10% of all reports are false. Okay. So that means 90% are correct.
And yet 80% of women are afraid to come forward.
Right. And
probably because they feel it's going to be accused of giving a false report.
Yeah. And a lot of those false reports, quote unquote, are unfounded, which just means we couldn't prove that something happened. Doesn't mean that the person lied or that it was wrong. But for whatever reason, we've decided that that is more important than the survivors coming forward. For some reason, we are able to understand how a false accusation could ruin someone's life, but we can't understand how the actual act of rape could ruin someone's life. So we're kind of wanting to throw the baby out with the bathwater, which just doesn't make any sense to me. It is an injustice, right? If there is, in fact, a false report made, someone has lied, that's wrong. It's not okay. I don't condone that in any way, shape, or form. But the fact that a small percentage of those things have happened doesn't mean that you ignore the bigger problem. And quite frankly, you know, there are false reports on all types of crimes. And this percentage isn't any different than any other crime, which basically means that people lie the same amount
right.
about all crime.
And yet, if it was a burglary suspect, we wouldn't treat that person different. But
no.
for some reason.
For some reason, domestic violence, physical violence, sexual assault, especially against women, it just becomes this thing where we don't know, we can't figure it out, we blame them. But we would never blame a person who had their house robbed. We would never say to them, did you leave your door unlocked? Were your windows open so they could see your nice TV? You know, what did you do to make this happen? We would never say that.
Are you planning on divorcing your spouse and maybe you're taking stuff
right.
out of the house?
Why are you lying about this, right? And because we think you're lying, we're not going to investigate. We're not going to take care of it. We're not going to do anything, right? We
right.
would never do that. Same with drinking, right? Sexual violence is the only crime we excuse because someone was drinking, right? We'll say like, oh, he was drinking. He didn't know what he was doing. But we don't excuse drunk driving. We wouldn't excuse if you robbed a bank.
Vehicular homicide, yeah.
No, we don't excuse. Alcohol is not an excuse for anything except for sexual violence.
Wow. My guest today is Brenda Tracy. She is an activist against sexual assault on campus. She was gang raped in 1998 by 4 men, including 2 Oregon State football players. She began speaking out in 2014 and has now spoke at a number of college campuses.
Yeah.
You went to Baylor right after that scandal broke, and that was a particularly heinous one because nearly all the players had had incidents at other schools that were covered up. They transferred to Baylor. They had more incidents, and the school just did not take any precautions. You went after the school had fired the head coach, Art mm-hmm. Briles, and I believe the school president.
The president and
Ken
the athletic
Starr,
director.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
and the athletic director. And at that time, the players were open to it, but yet some of the coaches from the previous regime were not open at that particular time.
Yeah, it was interesting. Coach Grob was the interim coach at the time, and he invited me. He had talked to Coach Mike Riley. I had been to Nebraska to talk to his team. And so I went there. Coach Grob was very open. We had, I think we had dinner. I think it was like a 3-hour dinner or something. And we just talked and talked and talked. And then I went into the team room and I talked with the football players, and everything seemed to be fine. And then when I was done, one of the assistant coaches pulled me aside immediately. As soon as I was done, I didn't get a chance really to talk to anybody, but just immediately pulled me aside into his office. The Title IX coordinator at the time, who has left, she resigned, and I think she filed a complaint with the education department. She followed me into the office. I think she must have, looking back, I think she knew, like, uh-oh, this is not good that he's pulling her aside. So she followed me into the office. And then, you know, he spent about 45 minutes just kind of
convincing you that you were wrong.
Why are you here? Who brought you? There's no problem in the football department. We don't have any issues here. This is all a conspiracy against us and Coach Art Briles, and was really defending him and trying to convince me that nothing was going on there, and was angry, very defensive. And it was a really disturbing conversation for me. And then by the time I got out of his office, everybody was gone. So I did tell my contact person there. I said, you know, this is not okay. His attitude and his beliefs are dangerous, and any good I did here today is going to be undone by him if this is the attitude of the coaching staff. And then, of course, a series of events happened. It all blew up on ESPN and Outside the Lines and the whole thing. And I got kind of embroiled in this scandal with Baylor after that. And it's been a interesting relationship since then. I've had my opinions about what should happen. I've spoke out publicly against Art Briles getting another job. And some of the fan base is really angry with me. So I received death threats. I received rape threats. A lot of bullying. A lot of name calling.
From a Christian Baptist university.
Yes, from the fan base mostly. Yeah. Which is, you know, I guess it's fine. It's not, but it's part of, you know, what I do now. And so I deal with it. But, you know, I'm happy that Coach Matt Rhule is there now. I think that he's the right man for the job. I think that he's doing a lot of good work with that football team. He's got a good staff there. I know that the school has implemented a lot of recommendations. I don't know, you know, I don't think recommendations changes culture. So looking at the bigger picture of the school, I think that's going to take years, and it's going to take a lot of work to change that culture.
Yeah. And you mentioned you had been to Nebraska, and you actually met Mike Riley, who was the coach at Oregon State when you were attacked, and is now at Nebraska. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, he was the man you hated worse than the perpetrators.
Yeah.
What happened when you met with him? And met with the team, I guess.
So when my story came out, Coach Riley hit the message boards and kind of apologized for his, you know, kind of his role, and invited me to speak to his football players at Oregon State if I wanted, and to meet with him. That didn't happen. And then he left and went to Nebraska. And I really thought when he left that, like, we in Oregon, we all got up one day and he was just gone. Like, we had no idea he was leaving. He literally left in the middle of the night.
Coaches sometimes do that.
Right. And it was very abrupt, and we were all very surprised. But when I read the article, I thought, oh, I'm never going to hear from him again, because I hadn't met him yet. I hadn't gone to the school yet. So I thought, you know, I'm probably a PR nightmare for him. He's gone to Nebraska now. I'll probably never hear from him again. But Coach Riley kept reaching out to me, and he invited me. He said, you know, I would still like to meet you if you want to do that. And if you wanted to talk to my team, I think that would be really impactful. And so last summer, I finally got up the courage and I went to Nebraska. And I met him, and I sat down with him face to face, and we talked for about an hour and a half. And I literally told him how much I had hated him for all those years, and what he said, and how it hurt me, how it affected my life. And Coach Riley was amazing. He held himself accountable to me, and he allowed me to say everything I needed to say. And then went into the team room, and he held himself accountable before his team. Wow. And I told them the story. And he stood kind of off to the side where they could all see him. And I told them the story and his involvement and what he had said and how he had handled things. And I even said to them, I said, quote, unquote, I hated your coach more than my rapist. And they looked at me, and then they looked at Coach Riley, and then they looked back at me. And you could tell they're like, we don't know what to do with that comment. Like, how do we act right now? And I explained to them what I explained to you, that I can rationalize rapists. Yeah. They couldn't rationalize good people not doing the right thing. And so we talked about accountability, and we talked about what it was to be a man. And I talked about how I felt, you know, they were blessed to have a coach with so much courage, right? Because I think it took courage for Coach Riley to stand in that room with me And I tell other teams this, you know, I tell them, think about the story I just told you. What if that was your coach?
Right.
Right? What was that? What if that was your coach?
Well, let me ask you the more difficult question. Is there any sense that when inevitably a story comes like this at his new coaching job, is he reacting differently?
You know, I believe he will. I guess only time will tell.
Right.
And if the situation happens, then we'll see what happens. But I absolutely believe that this is something that did affect him. I mean, Coach Riley and I now have a true friendship now today. And I went back just a couple months ago for the spring game, and I sat in his suite and watched the game and everything. And he really does care about me.
You've talked to a number of university athletic departments. You feel like things are changing in the places you see? I mean, obviously, if they invite you, they can care enough to at least get this message out to the players.
Yeah, and I think it's important to understand that I don't market myself.
Right.
Like, I don't solicit any school to bring me in. Obviously, there's, kind of, passive marketing as far as, like, news stories and things. But every school seeks me out. They find my email. They find my contact. They talk to someone, whatever, get in touch with me. So schools are being proactive by bringing me on their campus. And I think that means something. And I think the fact that we're doing this, that we're having this discussion, that coaches are getting on board and saying this is an issue we need to talk about, I think all of that means that things are shifting. I don't think things have shifted to where they need to be, right? It's a work in progress, but it's starting. And I'm happy to be at the beginning of this change. And I think that, years down the road, we will see some change.
Now, as we speak now, there's some question over whether the Dear Colleague letter from the Department of Education will still remain in force, that the Education Department is maybe considering, the Trump administration department is considering rescinding that letter. What do you think the outcome will be if that actually happens? Do you think universities will go back to the old ways, or?
I don't know how the colleges are going to respond. I hope that they continue to do what they've been doing. It's really upsetting for me to think that we would be rolling back this letter, because I just don't feel like it's been enough years for us to figure it out. I think that obviously there are flaws and there are things we should work on, but I think getting rid of it is not the answer at all. I think that we could do better, but I think that that's something that happens over time. You know, I think what's happened is that we've had some pushback on this whole idea of the false reporting and that, people's lives are being ruined. And I'm just screaming from the mountaintop that people's lives are still going to be ruined, right. And they have been getting ruined, right? But there's somewhere where you find justice for everyone, and we need to keep working on that. So I hope the schools will continue on their own to keep doing this work, regardless of what the federal government says. And I hope that different states will rally and codify these laws in their own states, because we can do that. I'm already in talk with legislators in Oregon about how, if Title IX is rolled back on a federal level, what can we do in our own state to protect our own students? And so I hope that we see people rallying on a state level to create state laws to protect their students on their campuses, because there is a way to do it in a just and fair way.
All right. Well, Brenda Tracy, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Brenda Tracy is a registered nurse and an activist against sexual assault on college campuses. You can learn more about her story at brendatracy.com. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.